we know we're not 100% right. In fact, sometimes we're really wrong, but we want to be less wrong more quickly.
Are we recording?
Oh my God. Better Product, the only show that takes a behind-the-scenes look into how digital products are created,
the businesses built around them, and how you too can innovate better product.
I'm Christian.
I'm Anna.
Welcome to today's show.
We're all familiar with the story of the prodigal son, right?
Where are you going with this?
Oh, okay. Hear me out on this. Craig Sturgis is the VP of product at Smarter HQ. When the company was in its infancy, he was a team member.
Is this the joke? Does the infant equal the son? Because that's lame and a major stretch.
Hold on, Anna. So he was part of the original team at Smarter HQ.
Original is a better word, or founding.
He had left to start his own company. That company sold, and he found himself with the opportunity to rejoin the Smarter HQ team.
I was kind of going on a path towards starting my own company again when the opportunity came up from people who I used to work with, I liked working with, saying, hey, we really need someone who has experience in product management to help us out.
So, as Christian shared, Craig was a part of the startup team, then rejoined to help the company scale. This excited him and gave him a new challenge to take on.
I think a lot of it was the ability to really develop the process to understand what our customers are trying to solve, how to best solve it, and then apply learnings that I've had elsewhere to really help a development team that was really more technically focused try to learn to be more customer focused.
Before we get further into Craig's story, let's take a pause to tell our listeners why Smarter HQ exists.
Great idea, Christian.
Oh, thanks, Anna. Now you like my ideas? Smarter HQ is
a personalization platform for consumer-facing marketers. So think big brands like Macy's, Bloomingdale's, Sam's Club, hotel chains like Hilton. We're helping marketing teams at those groups personalize their messaging in a way that's most relevant.
Craig set out to solve specific challenges. Starting out, he had to dig into project management, not product management.
Working with the team that was there to really put one foot in front of the other and stay focused and aligned on just let's get all of our customers on the same tech platform, which is what they've been struggling with for a couple of years.
Once he got some initial obstacles out of the way, clearing of the forest, if you will.
Clever.
He shifted the focus to what he refers to as modern product management. This is the initiative that gets Craig out of bed in the morning. Let's hear why.
A lot of product management, as I've experienced it, or at least as I'm familiar with it, like, and especially in B2B and enterprise-focused companies, is very much more project-focused. It is very much take the request, like in the office space sense, take the requirements from the customers to the engineers and break them down, and kind of more of a I don't even want to put it as agile versus waterfall. It's very much more task-oriented. It is the business wants this. Like Marty Kagan refers to it as more of an IT mindset versus a product mindset, where it's like the business needs this and we need to undertake these steps and build this machine, these sets of features so that we can make money. Whereas the mindset that I'm more interested in is a more customer-focused mindset. It is we need to understand and meet the needs of our customers in a way that serves the needs of our business. And so that involves much more understanding and much more direct connection to your customers, your buyers, your users. We are an enterprise-focused company. And so it isn't just about our users. Oftentimes, people making the buying decision about our product don't actually use our product at all. And so you're having to sort of think about what's going to be valuable to the people who are making the buying decision, who are putting their necks on the line to buy your product and get the return of value on it. And then how do you empower the users of your product to help in that? And it's this whole like complex system of people that you have to understand and serve their different, very different needs in a way that they feel the value, both for their day to day and for when they're taking it. I often talk about like what they then take and put on the PowerPoint presentation to their boss being the primary like indicator of whether we continue being and serving them as customers or whether they choose to use something else.
So in order to make your product team more modern, again, it's changing from task focus to customer focus. So like what are the actual like tactical things that you do to start that process?
I work with a lot of really smart, really talented people, but I think a lot of times I felt like I was speaking a completely different language, or it, just the assumptions about what product management is and what their previous experience, like they just weren't familiar with it. And so a lot of times it was, well, this team over here talks to the customers and they give us the feedback and then we go and we take that and we make sense of it and we turn it into the sprint backlog. But a lot of times what I would try to do is just try different techniques. One of the ones that I started out of the gate and have tried to maintain over time is this idea of adopting a customer. So let's bring in we have a client success team and they're the people who primarily own the relationship with our customers. And so let's bring them in and talk about the ongoing relationship with one of our customers. Let's talk about what we talked about on our last status call. Let's talk about what we talked about our last business review from a strategic perspective. What are they struggling with? We succeed when our customers succeed. So what's the next step? What are they doing to continue to grow, to continue to see success? And how are they using our product to do that? How is our team using our product on behalf of our customer in order to help them do that? It's usually a mix because they're really complex systems. And so how can I record a conversation or record an interview with the permission of our customer and play it back for the team or give it to them in a way that they can listen back to it and get some sense of direct connection to that customer, because every one of us is going to get a different insight from a conversation or an interaction with a customer. And so how can we listen to the same conversation together and then discuss it to see, what did you get from that? Or you're going to bring a different perspective to this.
Craig, this is all really great tactics. I'd love to understand how you've applied this specifically on maybe any project or initiative at Smarter HQ.
One of the things that comes to mind is our big focus right now, how do we uncover insights from all the data that we collect, activate, and help kind of automate messaging on? Like, we're really, really good at that. We're helping you do really complex stuff across a bunch of different ways that you message with your customers. But what we continually hear either indirectly through our account team or directly from customers is like, what does the data tell you that I can't get access to? And so that's a really broad question. So how do we dig into the specifics of that? So we've launched kind of this ongoing effort that's really a cross-functional team that includes members of our sort of our client success group, our sales and solutions engineering group, myself, my team, our head of design, as well as some more technical folks too, and our data science folks. Let's have specific conversations with customers. Let's recruit individual customers that have asked us these questions before, and let's get really dig in and have conversations with them ongoing and align a kind of an ongoing cadence that's not just about, hey, here's what's on the roadmap and here's what we're doing. It's more of a discovery conversation where we're having broad kind of customer interviews that are meant to be recorded and played back for the team so they can get insights about them, but saying, okay, great. You asked me, what can you see from the data? Well, what would you like to see? What are questions that you can't answer by working with your analytics team today or the team that's building reports for you? We have all this data that we could choose to bubble up and report on, but really what we're looking for, and we're looking to produce ad hoc, we're using our teams doing things that don't scale to produce a report or insight saying, like, here's what we found. Does that look good to you? And so playing it back, it's almost like a mix of prototyping via like spreadsheet and report and PowerPoint deck that is trying to get at in this ongoing cadence of, we can produce this insight. How is that working for you? What's useful about that for you? What else along these lines would you like to see? And we're using that to drive not only more understanding about how our customers measure success or the types of data points that are valuable to them, which is related but almost totally different than what our product has done traditionally, which is just, we drive messaging, it makes you money, it helps you build better relationships with customers. But there's also this whole other side and product opportunity for us that both reinforces the primary value of, hey, not only did I make this much revenue from this messaging campaign, but I'm seeing this level of engagement of people who receive these messages go up. Or they're really loving working with this product, where we're trying to really do a deep dive and insight of something we it's not our core business. Like, we want to build products that scale up, that we can do this for everybody, but doing it in a way that, in the Paul Graham sense of do things that don't scale, in order to validate what's going to be really valuable across cross sections of our customers. And so building those relationships, having the raw conversations captured and recorded in ways that we can take back to the team, so that all the different perspectives, whether it's people who own the relationship, people who sell to new customers, or people who build the actual product, can bring all the different insights and discuss together, how are we going to make a better solution for our customers, and is that applicable broadly?
When you started this project, and you said you recruited customers that had been asking questions before in this ongoing fashion. Are you focusing industry by industry now, or however you segment, and then looking to scale after that? Or are you trying to do a cross-section at the beginning of a research project like this?
We do focus on specific industry verticals inside consumer fate, like retail and hospitality are our two biggest ones. And so what we look to do is try to identify like five or six people in ways that we can manage that, like five or six customers and five or six kind of direct contacts that we have good relationships with that are both willing to spend the time with us without necessarily needing to like go overboard to incentivize them, which probably would skew their response anyway. But in general, they also, we're going to produce as a result of this research something that's valuable to them in their day-to-day life. So we're trying to find people both that will work with us, but that are also representative of our customer base and our target like market.
You mentioned a few times that you're doing ongoing research. Why not just conduct a study, say over this next few weeks, we're going to conduct a study with this customer, we're going to go talk to them, and then we're going to write up a report, and it's going to drive our roadmap. What's the rationale behind creating ongoing research with these customers, and how do you do that?
One of the challenges that we have is that we don't have a giant sample of people to go do a big single research study against, but also it's our product development is ongoing. We're developing, we are shipping, we are building, we are learning in an ongoing way. And so if we had the ability to continually get feedback as we're changing our product, I think that's going to be better feedback, better insight, better learning from what our customers are telling us over time, because we're going to be wrong. Like, I think in general, no, we work with smart people. They have really good ideas for solutions, but you'll never know until those solutions actually hit the market and a customer tries to use them to get value. And so you're going to learn new things all the time and have new things for them to react to. And that's going to only help you get better if you're continually following up, continually asking for feedback and asking the same questions, helping them react to things.
So you talk to customers and then you mentioned going back to them. Tell me a little bit more about what that process looks like and why, what those like kind of follow-ups are.
We have a regular scheduled time. We're trying to meet with them once a month. We don't always stay on that, but we're always working to get back in front of them. We build something, we put it together, and ideally we start with a spreadsheet or mock-ups, and then eventually we're putting real product in front of them. But even when we're doing just kind of those static artifacts, we want to learn from what their feedback is and come back and show it to them again. In general, we know we're not 100% right. In fact, sometimes we're really wrong, but we want to be less wrong more quickly.
So you mentioned utilizing both qualitative and quantitative data. Kind of, you have a hypothesis, now let's confirm it. Tell me a little bit more about that and what that part, that process plays in your research.
Typically, when we're choosing to focus on an area of product development for a good long time. Like, in general, I think this is a really good way to approach product management of any product, but it's, we have this goal for this customer has this goal, or we believe they have this problem. We're going to focus on all the different ways we can solve that problem. And so let's write it down. Let's say, here's what our hypothesis is about this. Here's the high level sort of solutions we're thinking about, but here's how we're going to measure success, right? And that might be a qualitative measure. It might be a quantitative measure. In an ideal world, everything's quantitative. It's measurable. Not everything is, though. I mean, there are stories upon stories, especially in kind of B2B and enterprise context, where they're a happy customer, they're a happy customer, they're a happy customer, then they're gone. And so what were the indicators you could have been looking for to understand that? So we define our hypothesis. We work with all the different people on our cross-functional team from all the different perspectives to think about okay, what are those problems? How can we firm those up? What are possible solutions that we could really tease out and measure and then find out what's feasible and potentially go build a prototype, go build a mock-up, go actually build it for real and put it in front of customers. What can we iterate and then see in our analytics whether they're doing what we expect them to do? And I do think both of those things are really important. Having enough checkpoints and building a pipeline and cadence of customer conversations to go along with when you're looking at your analytics reports. We use a tool called Pendo to help us understand how people are flowing through the product, but that's only one piece of the story. Because as I mentioned, our customers, the people who make the buying decision, are almost never the people who are actually using the software. And so looking at our product analytics is not going to tell us whether the person who makes the final decision and who is our champion inside a really big, complex organization is getting what they need out of working with us.
Does the buyer research always have to be qualitative then, if they're not in your product?
I mean, it mostly has to be. I think there are ways, and honestly, with the initiative that we're talking about, one of our goals is to get our buyers into our product more, because we're going to produce something that's going to be more valuable in their day-to-day life. So it's kind of selfish in that we want to find ways to get them to log into our UI and our platform in ways that we can see quantitatively. And hopefully that's more scalable, because there are only so many of us and scheduling busy people is hard. That's something that helps us get another window into the life of our buyer versus our day-to-day users.
You said you wanted your product team, your developers, to have direct contact to customers. Why is that important?
Each of us has different perspectives, different insights. We have different tools. We all know something, come at it with a unique perspective. And so I think when you have a conversation together, when you play back an interview, ideally when you're in the room together with a customer or observing them trying to solve a problem that your product is meant to solve, the developer is going to get an entirely different perspective on it, and they're going to be able to tell something and then act on it in a way that I can't. And then if we're working on that and our client success director, who owns the relationship, is also watching the same interaction, we can discuss it afterwards and all come to a better common understanding than any of us could on our own. Or if we're trying to play it through play telephone and say, I just got off the phone with this customer and they said this. Like, that might be true, but you're missing out on maybe other context that they also said that the person who owns a relationship might not think to relay. I feel like there's kind of this philosophical divide in technology where people think, especially in software, that the people building the product, I think to many people, they're worker bees, that you give them a set of tasks and they just go and build and build and build. They're there to like build the spec. But I think realistically, the people who build the product are not worker bees. They are problem solvers. They hunger and crave to be given a problem to solve, and they can't really solve it well unless they have some amount of direct contact and insight about the person they're solving the problem for.
Do you think your experience as a developer moving into product management helps you have this perspective, or how else have you kind of come to this philosophical understanding?
Sure. I think it's a really common thing, and there, I mean, other people of my tribe, like the software developers who really want to solve problems and solve problems for customers, there are many of us. And so I do think that drives a lot of my perspective. One of the reasons I moved into a product role from an engineering role was I want to empower more of that. The really big insight that drove it was when I started my own company with my partners, I was really focused on, I did the product role because there were only a few of us and somebody had to do it. And so I was sort of stacking up and saying, okay, well, what are the things we should do in which order? And I was really focused on process and efficiency and shipping more product more quickly. But then what I learned over time is it doesn't matter how efficient you are at shipping the product if it's not the right product. And so that's what really pushed me fully over the edge into, wow, how do I solve these sets of problems so that the people who are really, and honestly, way better at me than writing code, can be more effective at doing it and we can win together.
Craig, put you on the spot. So you've been doing this for a year and a half. You've implemented a lot of these modern product changes. How do you know whether anything is successful or not?
I mean, I think, are our customers successful? Are they more successful than they were before? I mean, it's not dramatically different. I think we're still paying down a lot of the cost up front to really realize the benefit. But I think our odds are much better of realizing that than they would be if we were not putting in the work and grinding through a lot of this stuff that some people don't feel is necessary. But I do think our odds are much better than if we weren't doing it.
It seems like what you're implementing with this modern product management approach is not something that you just implement for quick wins. It seems like it's more like foundational and building up over time. Would you agree with that, or am I characterizing that right?
Yeah, and it is. It's a lot of quick wins on the way to big wins. You do have to be satisfied with small wins at first, but then it basically makes it more likely you're going to get the big win later.
What does better product mean to you?
Better product means you deliver more value for customers in a way that helps you build a viable, sustainable, growing business.
Craig gave us a lot of great details around the difference between sort of old school or old fashioned product management and new product management. But the one thing that I would love to focus with you on is his description on why they do ongoing research rather than these big research studies.
Can the modern PM have it all?
Find out right now. So first off, what do we mean by ongoing research? You've talked about this a lot, even in our own work, and you've used the term, what is the word?
Progressive synthesis.
So progressive synthesis your mind and ongoing research, what does that mean?
It's our agile approach to research. And it's similar to what Craig talked about. So, I mean, what he said is that they have a monthly cadence with customers. They find they're friendly, the customers that are finding success, and they just talk with them once a month. And so his rationale for doing that is that product development is continuing to move and that they always have questions to be answered. They always want to be checking in. I mean, we do that a lot too. Again, we're consider ourselves an agile agency. And, you know, I feel like user research a lot of times is one of the last true waterfall, you know, processes, really. I mean, it's one of those things where you line up your users, you do a big study, you learn from them, you have output, you share the findings, then you make decisions based on it. And I think that we prefer to be much more agile in that way. And again, similar to what Craig said, there's value in those big, you know, you want to go really deep, you want a lot of people, you want to learn all about a new market, like taking the time to do that, it can be really valuable. But if you're in an agile, product process, you want to get those insights and act on them and keep going. And just, you know, you're acting on these things, but you're also gathering too. You're gathering, we call it progressive synthesis because we look for themes and we build on those themes as we continue and talk to more people. So we'll start to see a trend form. And if other people say it, we'll build on the trend, or maybe the trend will die. And so we just kind of go with what we're hearing and try to make decisions as we do.
Yeah, that reminds me of that great quote that he had of trying to be less wrong more quickly.
Exactly.
This is a personal battle I've had with my wife, who is a one time a PhD candidate in anthropology, and she looked at the way that we conducted research and was like, that's like discount research. And I was like, yeah, it kind of is. But the way that he put it, that's why our research methods are slightly different when it's not for science, because it's really just like you're not actually trying to conduct a research to figure out, okay, what is the one true answer here?
Exactly.
We're building product. You're just trying to reduce uncertainty.
Right. We always say, and this is kind of a philosophy that at least I was exposed to via Eric Stolterman's book, The Design Way. He talks about the difference between what is true and what is real. So true is something that's true in all environments. Gravity is always true. I mean, unless I go to the moon, I'm basically going to experience the same way everywhere. And that's not the type of research we're doing, where we want to know what's real to people, and real can change. But what we want to do is capture what's real right now. And that's why we don't, do a set number of participants. And that's why we don't have variables, or I don't even know the science words.
We don't even know the science words.
We do research to the point where it can inform the product, and we learn what we need to learn, and then we just continue on.
Yeah, and maybe that act of doing it ongoing reduces the confidence you put into it, which sounds bad, but it's more like we're not doing this research to get rid of all the fears or the anxieties that we've got it all right. It's like we're accepting the fact that things do change and we're just going to chip away at it. We're not trying to do this to come to what you said, to come out with the truth. We're just doing it on an ongoing basis. Another aspect he mentioned when we asked him why they do ongoing research is they don't have a giant sample size. Even if you're not starting something from scratch right now, I think you may face a similar issues as Craig, which is that you don't have a really diverse customer base. You may have 15 customers that have, you know, 40 users each, but they're not really diverse. So if you're going to do, you know, a real study, that might not be a big sample size.
When we build product, it's not that we want to be 100% correct, because you can't be. You're bringing people a vision that they may not even know that they want, but you want to lessen what you don't know. So again, I think that does go to less wrong more quickly. You get some information, you have a hypothesis, you test the hypothesis, and you find out if it worked or not. And that's also too, I think, where Craig mentioned this a bit, mixing your qualitative and your quantitative data, right? So they're using the qualitative, it sounds like the qualitative information they're getting from their customers and these, like, you know, once a month recurring interviews, but then also watching their quantitative analytics and then maybe looking for cross sections there. So
yeah, that also reminds me of something he said where he was talking about, without the qualitative aspect, you can just sort of see that they seem like a happy customer, happy customer, happy customer, and then one day they're gone and they don't know why.
Right.
So if they're not also supplementing with the analytics, like the analytics and the product might not hint at them leaving you. It might tell you where there's opportunities, but it may not hint at that. But if he supplements that with, you know, ongoing conversations and understands how those two things are merging, he can get a much better picture of where there's opportunities for unmet needs.
Yeah, and you know, we shared an article around here that was done by the Spotify research team, and they have data scientists on their research team. You know, they use their qualitative information to find really interesting hypotheses, and they'll test it with the quantitative side, or they'll use the quantitative side to say, hey, we're seeing something that's weird. Let's do some interviews to follow up with it. So really, like, using those complementary methods. I mean, and again, maybe that's where we're pulling more from the science field, or we're trying to, like, triangulate.
Well, I think what you're saying is right. And the idea of triangulation is important here. There's not just one source of data. It's also, I think you're bringing up another point that's come up a few times on this podcast, of being data informed. So we've seen this theme pop up in a few ways: customer informed versus customer driven, or data informed versus, you know, data led decision making. Maybe Jeremy Leventhal from Springbuck talk a little bit about it. But the idea being that, even like you said, having data science on your team, or even just looking at the data, the answer is not just self-evident. You don't just, like, look at the data and be like, okay, I clearly know what we need to do with our product. I look at Pendo, I look at these. You do have to triangulate. You have to, you know, be talking to customers. You've got to, you know, be working with your customer support team, understanding what your team's building, to really form, like, better hypotheses, and doing it on an ongoing basis rather than just saying, this is the answer. The data tells me that. It's like the data is hinting at something. We've got to fill in the blanks with other sources.
And I want to caveat this too, to say, it's not just a matter of doing research. You have to be somewhat thoughtful in your methodology and your approach to the research. It's not just a matter of having data. You have to have the right data. It's asking the right questions too. So it's not just, you know, a 10-minute call with your users where you ask them how much they like these features. It really, it's beyond. That's a great first step. Get out there, get talking to people. But there's correct methodologies to use as well.
And so you're saying that you don't just pick up the phone and say, like, how much do you love this feature? Like, a little bit, or like a lot? So when we think about ongoing research, so we've talked a little bit about conducting it and what you're doing afterwards. Now you're saying, hold on, let's also make sure in the beginning that we're prepping it right. Do you think that you have to be revisiting the way that you prepare research on an ongoing basis? Or can you kind of have a methodology and say, look, these are the types of questions we're going to ask. Do those need to change as well? Or can you kind of keep asking those same things and just sort of, you know, be changing the people that you're asking them of?
There's a really great article written by Erica Hall, who is a really, really smart researcher. I believe she works for Mule Design. But she has a great article called Research Questions Are Not Interview Questions. And basically it breaks down the difference between what is a research question versus an interview question. A research question is something you're set out to answer. And there's a couple aspects of a research question. It has to be something you can actually answer. It has to be something that fits, you know, what you want to learn more about. And so it's a good way to think about how to get at what you want with people without just how much do you like feature X?
Right. No, I think it's really great feedback. So kind of to recap on in terms of like the ongoing research aspect, it's a great methodology to use pretty much anytime in product.
Yeah, there's definitely. The more contact with your customers, the better, right?
Right. And you know, it's good for if you don't have a great, you know, giant sample. And even if you're doing it, it sort of helps you be, you know, to steal Craig's quote again, to be less wrong more quickly.
Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. If you haven't yet, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Until then, visit innovatemap.com/podcast and subscribe to learn how you can take your product to the next level. As always, we're curious, what does better product mean to you? Hit us up on Twitter at InnovateMap or shoot us an email at podcast@innovatemap.com.
I'm Christian.
And I'm Anna. And you've been listening to Better Product.
Better Product.
Drop mic.